versus Frank Russell.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Kaplow, and I am counsel for Frank Russell Investments. Looks like you're reserving 2 minutes.
Will you tell me?
Does that sound good? That sounds fine. Maybe I'll even reserve 3, if that's right.
You have 2.
I'll take it. This appeal involves the trial court's award of prevailing party attorney's fees and costs to Ms. Bright, even on her race-based claims that were determined to lack any merit. Ms. Bright's original lawsuit made the charged accusation that Frank Russell was a racist organization.
Let's cut to the chase here, and what I'd like to do is talk about the trial court's oral decision, in which it applied the Supreme Court case of Hensley, finding that there was a common core of facts and related legal theories, which under Hensley allows for recovery for items that otherwise might not be subject to recovery. So would you address why you believe the trial court abused its discretion in applying those two elements, the common core of facts and related legal theories, under Hensley?
The trial court's ruling, and this is, I think, validated in the written order and in the appellate briefing as well, was based on a finding that that common core of facts, and those words do appear, arise by virtue of the fact that both of the claims, both categories of claims, the race-based claims and the disability accommodation claims, arose under Washington law against discrimination. What the court was finding was that two things. One, which is paragraph 14 of the order, is that by operation of law, Washington law against discrimination unified these two claims. And the second thing, this is paragraph 15 of the order, is that the defense, the painting the plaintiff in a bad light, unified the claims. So the court was not undertaking a traditional Hensley analysis or a FAM analysis in looking at whether substantively the two claims had a common core of operative facts. The court was reaching that conclusion by operation of law effectively. And our contention here is that even if the court had reached that conclusion, it should have then undertaken the second step to look at whether the degree of success.
So is your position that neither a common core of facts nor related legal theories exist in this particular case? Would justify, under Hensley, the award?
It's not just my position, it's plaintiff's position as well. I think if you turn to page 33, the very top of plaintiff's brief, it says very clearly that the fact that all of Bright's claims arose under WLAD was not the only reason for the trial court's decision. And then she says, turning to paragraph 15, the same statement I made to you earlier, the trial court determined it was Russell's defense that created a common core of facts. And again, that's page 33 of the briefing. So the point I want to make here is that these two claims, I think, substantively and procedurally, were very different from each other. They were brought at different times in the case, they involve very different issues. If you think about discrimination claims, whether they're race discrimination, sex discrimination, gender discrimination, those are injunctions to an employer. Those are shall nots. When you have a disability discrimination claim, disability accommodation claim, those... I understand it, and certainly this is an abuse of discretion standard in this case, but when is here the trial court's determination is based on an untenable basis, that becomes a legal issue.
What is untenable about concluding factually that your presentation kept intertwining facts between the claims so that the same set of facts and same set of efforts were necessary for both?
Mm-hmm.
What's untenable about reaching that factual conclusion?
Well,
I mean, his point is the plaintiff didn't do it.
That's right.
Your client did it.
That's right. And I think that there's two ways to possibly look at this. One is if you flip the argument around. I think it's very helpful in my mind. What if the plaintiff made the argument, my theory of the case was to paint Frank Russell in a bad light. And the way I did that was I brought a race claim, I brought claims against Mr. Golob, and that was part of my effort to paint them in a bad light for purposes of my claim that there was a failure to accommodate this disability. Well, clearly that wouldn't unify the claims. Well, it's even more attenuated when you start arguing that a defendant's themes, trial themes, can start unifying a case. The test here is not, the test correctly is whether or not the party prevails on their claim. And I would say that's not even the applicable test. And the second factor is, I think if you look, if this common defense truly unified the case, then Mrs. Bright would have prevailed on both of her claims or failed on both of her claims.
That's not necessarily so, because this is a jury trial. And for a variety of reasons that sometimes lawyers and judges will never know, it's hard to know why a jury does what it does.
For sure. It's a black box. But the fact of the matter is, it was not an affirmative defense. It was a theme, and it wasn't a persuasive theme. It didn't determine the outcome of the case, either on all the claims to be granted or all the claims to be denied. There's no precedent. No case is ever held, and I've searched the entire United States. I've never found a case that looks at a defendant's trial themes to determine whether they're...
You seem to be arguing the facts.
I'm to be clear, I'm saying the trial court erred as a matter of law in two respects. One, in basing the ruling on this unitary statute theory, in saying essentially that by operation of law, WLAD unifies otherwise unrelated claims. That's an error of law. And the second error of law is to rely on a defendant's trial themes to determine if somebody is a prevailing party rather than the claims themselves.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Phil Talmadge and Judith Lundquist here representing Cindy Bright. Let me say at the outset, the trial court here did not abuse its discretion in entering its meticulous order on attorney fees with extensive findings of fact supported by ample evidence from experts and other evidence in support of those findings in the fee award that it rendered. I'm gratified by the proposition, first of all, that apparently counsel is abandoning some of the more ridiculous arguments that Frank Russell has made in connection with the fee issues. The first of which being the current hourly rate versus historic hourly rate issue, as well as the question about whether or not the trial court actually considered the degree of success that Ms. Bright had at trial. because in both instances, those arguments are utterly and completely baseless. The first being, from a legal standpoint, Washington case law has said over and over and over again that current rates, not historic rates, apply in the civil rights employment context. Fisher Properties, a Washington Supreme Court case, Mahler, a Washington Supreme Court case, this case, this court's case in FAM, a number of others, reject the proposition. And the argument is somehow attacking Ms. Lundquist. She altered her fee structure to have a higher rate, simply unsupported, as Judge Schubert found. In addition, the argument that somehow Judge Schubert did not consider the degree of success that was had here by Ms. Bright is simply false. The trial court entered careful findings of fact, as I've mentioned, and at findings number 5, number 6, and number 14, at the report of proceedings at 58 and 59, the trial court considered the degree of success she had and made its decision accordingly. To come to the proposition, to cut to the chase, as Judge Cox said, you have here extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law. You have findings of fact that are now undisputed because they haven't assigned error to any of these findings of fact in the trial court's fee order. And in those findings of fact, the court concluded that, first of all, Ms. Bright was the prevailing party. That's finding number 8, rejecting the argument that somehow, you know, we really prevailed on in this case, which has been Frank Russell's kind of implicit argument to this court on appeal. Simply wrong. High quality of representation, finding number 9. The hours that were incurred on Ms. Bright's behalf by Ms. Lundquist and her firm were reasonable, finding number 12. And, of course, there was the motion to compel on fees, and because they didn't produce their fees, their hours, in response to that motion to compel, the trial court's order indicated that it was going to conclude, in the absence of production of that information, that the hours spent by Frank Russell's lawyers were at least as great or greater than those that were spent by Ms. Bright's attorneys in this case. This goes to the point that's made in the Hensley case over and over again, that in acting as a private attorney general in this employment civil rights context, you want to compensate counsel who take on these very difficult matters roughly the same way that counsel would be compensated in the private marketplace, in particular by defense counsel in this setting.
What finding was that, number 12, did you say?
That was, ours were reasonable as number 12, but that is in the order on the motion to compel, Your Honor. No assignment of error to that order on the motion to compel. It's essentially undisputed in this case. This was a hard-fought case. Let's not lose sight of that fact. It was, it consumed 16 trial days over 4 weeks. It involved extensive discovery, extensive motions, and it was a battle. And counsel has stood up before the court and has conceded in his argument, as he must, that this court reviews the decision of the trial court on this fee award for an abuse of discretion. Cutting right away to the intertwined theories, Judge Lau's question is dead on point. This court in Miller, which we've cited to the court by way of supplemental authorities, indicates that the trial judge is in the best position to decide whether or not a common core of facts are present and whether legal theories are intertwined and so forth. It's a matter of trial court discretion. Judge Schubert did not abuse his discretion in making his decision here. He entered findings of fact on these issues. Findings number 14 and 15 indicated what his rationale was for this decision, and it was a reasonable one. Courts have upheld the proposition that trial courts can conclude that the common core of facts are present, and that legal theories are intertwined to such a degree that the segregation of time spent by counsel is not necessary.
So your position is both legs of Hensley are present in this case?
Correct, Your Honor. And we would go so far as to add one further thing, and that is our Supreme Court has indicated in certain kinds of circumstances, by their nature, the statutory claim, in the Brand case, it was the Industrial Insurance Act, but we would argue similarly in connection with the Washington law against discrimination, various theories for recovery under that statute can still result in a unitary recovery, and therefore all time spent to get to the unitary recovery by the party with its counsel exercising the private attorney general responsibility.
Now, you said can, but you said as a matter of law. One thing that I'd like to help clarify, are you saying that as long as multiple claims are pled, they must be recognized if the plaintiff prevails, that everything, even if one was frivolous.
No, not if it was frivolous, Your Honor, but if it was something that was a legitimate claim that was raised that resulted in the ultimate recovery on behalf of the plaintiff, under the unitary theory of recovery concept that the Supreme Court articulated in Brand, you get all of the attorney fees associated with that statutory claim that you've presented. Now, if you have separate claims that arise
three
by
out
common
of four go out on summary judgment. We don't have a determination they're frivolous, but they're out on summary judgment. All the work done on those, even if it's clearly separate and distinct, not recoverable as a matter of law,
under
or
Brand,
is recoverable as a matter of law.
Under Brand, the Supreme Court said that's exactly right. The dissent in that case, with which I'm very familiar, disagreed with that proposition, but the Supreme Court said, no, it's a unitary recovery, and that's that. And we would argue that the same kind of principle is true in the Washington law against discrimination. The court need not get there, though, if the court doesn't want to adopt that principle, because in response to Judge Cox's question, yes, our theory here is the theories are related, the common core of facts are present, the trial judge understood that, he entered meticulous findings of fact and conclusions of law to that effect, and under Hensley, under a variety of cases that we've cited, starting with Blair versus Washington State University, Hume, Mayer, Miller, all indicate that the trial judge in that position finding a common core of facts can do so, and there's no need to segregate the fees, and the fee award stands. The bottom line in this case is, notwithstanding all of the argument that you're now hearing, you have two arguments that are essentially baseless. The argument that you don't look at current rates in the civil rights context is simply a non-starter. The assertion that the trial judge here did not consider the degree of success at all is just blatantly false. The judge indicated that he considered these issues in his findings of fact and conclusions of law in his order. And then when we get to the final cut to the chase argument, common core of facts, related theories, you betcha, they were all common core. They were related theories. It started in the HR, executive team at Frank Russell. There were concerns about race issues as regards Ms. Bright. Those issues became even more pronounced as she had post-traumatic stress disorder, a disability that was not accommodated by Frank Russell, and that's ultimately what the jury hung its hat on in deciding that there was an appropriate recovery. This battle was a significant one, and the trial judge, in sitting there listening to all of the evidence and hearing this case over 16 trial days, was entitled to conclude that among the reasons for determining that a common core of facts was present was the very argument that Frank Russell made at trial sliming Ms. Bright. I mean, that's what they tried to do. That was their theory of the case, going after her the way they did. And their own actions, in effect, contributed to Judge Schubert's sense that there was a common core of issues present as a consequence. Did the trial court abuse its discretion? No. The fee order here evidenced the trial court was careful and deliberate, articulated his theory of why the fee award should be what it was appropriately. He calculated the lodestar. He denied a multiplier. Certain time was excluded. This was not just simply adopting whatever the plaintiffs asked for. And, whether a court might come to another conclusion, it might, but the question really boils down to, did Judge Schubert abuse his discretion? He did not. We ask that the court affirm and award fees on appeal to Ms. Bright. Thank you.
I'll start where counsel ended up in terms of time being excluded. In fact, zero time was excluded by the trial court. The only time that was removed was by counsel herself, involving mostly duplicate billing entries and billing entries for the wrong case. In terms of the historical rates, there was a rate increase, as you know, of up to 45% in the middle of the case. The reason why you're paid for historical rates is to provide for interest on the fees as they incur until they're paid. That's the purpose of paying historical rates. Obviously, in the time interval here, there wasn't a 45% interest rate. The citation to Miller, I think, is very useful because if you look closely at the Kenny versus Miller case, what the court was looking at there was slicing a motions in limine. The parties in that action were arguing that whether or not you won or lost, particular motions in limine should be considered as to whether or not you were the prevailing party. It obviously had nothing to do with a case like this, where you have race-based claims and you have disability accommodation claims that are completely separate from each other, as the trial court acknowledges in paragraph 15 of the order. And I think it's really important to take a look at paragraph 15 of the order in addition to the citation to the briefing that I gave you on 33. There's no contention whatsoever that these cases are related, and there's also no authority to adopt a unitary statute in the state of Washington for the WLTA. Thank you.